dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a privilege to be able to take advantage of the intelligence, in every sense of the word, of our first guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis, formerly served both in the United States Army and in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, as a man devoted to advancing the vital interests and particularly the national security of the United States, which he has done with great distinction even after he left government service. These days, he is doing it as a driving force behind a terrific online resource and magazine. He is an author, a former congressional candidate, an assistant attorney general out in Washington State, a man of considerable service and great capability, and we're honored to have him as one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back, Sam. Good to have you, man.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So much to talk with you about. I'd like to start with Afghanistan, and in particular, what is happening in its northern reaches, the Panjshir Valley, specifically, Sam. There are reports that there is an active resistance to the Taliban's misrule that is now fighting it out with the Taliban. The Taliban has claimed to have decisively defeated this resistance and secured the Panjshir Valley. What's your intelligence telling you is going on there?
Well, there is fighting in the Panjshir. The fighting is not over. The Taliban does not completely control the area, so they would like to declare victory and have the world just move on, but that is not reality. I think what one of the key things here for most people, because so much of the press distorts this, is to understand that while the President Ghani of Afghanistan left the country, the government did not cease to exist, and Vice President Saleh has remained in the Panjshir Valley. So the legitimate government of Afghanistan continues to exist and is resisting in the Panjshir Valley. And they have been asking for aid from the outside world, ever since the Taliban swept to power, and they have been completely ignored by the United States government. So we have folks in Afghanistan fighting to the death to try to preserve a democratic government, and we have the U.S. government under Joe Biden looking the other way.
And when you say looking the other way, that seems to me to signal that they're simply being passive. I'm worried, Sam, that they may be more actively throwing in with the Taliban than that. And in particular, I was struck by a comment that General Mark Milley, the very controversial and I would argue seriously flawed chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made over the weekend to the 10th Mountain Division's troops in Germany when he visited them there, to the effect that, you know, we don't want a civil war in Afghanistan because that could spawn terrorism. That seems wrong to me on so many different fronts. Terrorism that's going to be spawned there will be almost surely spawned by the Taliban's control. But give us a flavor of whether this indeed is likely to be the policy of the Biden administration, that they will support the Taliban over those that are seeking to challenge its renewed control and terror in Afghanistan.
Well, you're probably right. Saying they look the other way is really too kind, because it does diminish the scope of what we're looking at. I mean, it's hard for me sometimes to get my arms around this, because the scope of the lies being told by this administration, and I would include Milley in this crowd, are so mind-boggling that it's literally stupefying. I mean, it is a completely alternate reality, right? We have the Taliban has taken power now in most of Afghanistan. The administration somehow or another wants to conjure an image that the Taliban has evolved. It's kinder, gentler, fuzzier. It's not really a terrorist organization. If a bomb goes off, we're going to blame it on some splinter group, ISIS-K or somebody, and sort of suggest that the Taliban didn't want it to happen. And you know, this is all garbage. This is a complete fabrication being fed to the American people so they can sort of maybe make it more palatable, this what we're doing. I mean, the Taliban has not changed. The Taliban is a brutal 6th century evil creation. It's in the process of dragging Afghanistan right back to where it was 20 years ago, maybe worse. They're just more powerful now. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, the smell of this is that where we are headed with all of this endless lies is probably toward a day in the not so distant future where this administration is going to want to give diplomatic recognition to a Taliban, to a terrorist super state. And Blinken is already talking about how we fully intend to continue to funnel aid there with some sort of fiction that it will go through non-governmental organizations and therefore it won't really go to the Taliban, as if we would have any mechanism for controlling that, and as if anybody would believe that the Taliban will not immediately seize that. There's also a huge amount of money frozen abroad that belongs to the Afghan government. Think upwards of like $9 billion. I would assume at some point Joe Biden is going to release those funds as well. And so what this all adds up to is an American administration supporting a terrorist regime, choosing to support them. And when Milley says we don't want a civil war, what he means is we don't want anybody inside Afghanistan fighting for democracy, human rights, the rights of women. We don't want that. We need the Taliban to solidify its control. This is a supposedly an American general advocating that we really need to make sure the Taliban solidifies its control over Afghanistan.
This is disheartening in the extreme. Talk to us, if you could, a little bit, Sam, about you mentioned the former vice president, Amrullah Saleh, but leader of, well, warlord is the term often used, but this military resistance, Ahmed Massoud. What do we know about both of these men and their viability as real alternatives to the regime that is now in charge of Kabul, namely the Taliban?
Well, I mean, both of these guys are very substantial, very patriotic individuals who have dedicated themselves to the fight against the Taliban for decades now, and I think are both completely prepared to die if necessary in this fight. They are absolutely not going to submit. But, you know, right now, they are fighting against the Taliban. We are refusing to support them. I have also heard from sources on the ground that the one area in the country where it appears the U.S. military did destroy a lot of equipment and munitions before we withdrew was in the Panjshir, in exactly this area, which has historically been the center of resistance. So we somehow couldn't manage to keep the equipment from falling into the hands of the Taliban everywhere else, but we could disarm these guys before we walked out the door. Now, it's a little hard to believe that that's just by accident somehow. I mean, it suggests to you that in advance, people were thinking we don't need them being capable of mounting a resistance.
Sam, our colleague and fellow member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, Jeff Narquist, was on our show last week, I believe, and talked about a piece that had been published on his blog, authored by a man he knows but has not disclosed the identity of, apparently one of your former colleagues in the intelligence community, who's been on the ground in Afghanistan and who reported to Jeff that his take, based on what he's been seeing there, is that the administration has actually had in mind keeping people who might be able to reveal the full extent of, well, the hash up, one might call it, the betrayal, the humiliating strategic defeat that has taken place at the hands of the Biden team, to essentially condemn them to death at the hands of the Taliban by not facilitating their extraction from Afghanistan. I can't say whether that's true or not. I don't know whether you have any insights into it, but I would be interested in your reaction to that report.
Well, again, I can't confirm that. On the other hand, given the reality of what we're looking at, I don't think there's anything that you should take off the table. I mean, we are in completely uncharted waters. This is what's happening here is completely unprecedented. The Biden administration keeps bandying about now, I think, this idea that there might be 100 Americans in Afghanistan, and you know they're in contact with all of them, and there's sort of this suggestion that virtually all of them somehow or another want to stay. Again, this is all just a complete lie. I mean, the numbers that I'm hearing from the sources there is minimum 500, could be 1,000, could be upwards of that. And absolutely, these people do not want to stay, and they are not in contact with the U.S. government, and nobody is trying to get them out. There is absolutely nothing at all being done to rescue Americans. I mean, you think about this, when Jimmy Carter allowed hostages to be taken in Iran,
50 of them or so.
Every day, literally, I mean, an entire news program like was spawned, Nightline, to cover this hostage crisis. And talk precisely about how many Americans were there, and the entire country was seized with this. So this administration clearly remembers that. And so therefore, their intention is to simply erase completely, as if they just wipe them out of the public consciousness, could be easily 1,000 Americans trapped in Taliban territory. It's mind-boggling that an American president and, quite frankly, the Pentagon and everybody else, all these senior officials, all complicit in just lying to the American people and telling them, no, there's no such thing as 1,000 Americans in Afghanistan. We are abandoning these people to their fate.
And this just happens to be furthered by the news blackout that is descended on the country at the hands of the Taliban, is it not? And also, Sam, I was struck by a report that, of course, against the backdrop of whatever that number is, 100, 500, 1,000 more, not being on the planes that were, you know, departing out of Kabul because those seats were apparently occupied by some, at least, unvetted Afghans. And some cases, there were just empty seats, but they weren't on those flights, which is stunning in its own right. But beyond that, Sam, there was a report that I heard yesterday, I think, that we've had a number of Americans held up trying to get out of Mansar al-Sharif, one of the airfields further in the north, by the Taliban and by the State Department, apparently, over questions about whether they had the appropriate paperwork. Some clearly do, but this is in stark contrast to, well, attributed to chaos, if you will, but whatever the justification, the vast numbers, over 120,000, apparently, of Afghans, at least some of whom were brought out of Afghanistan and into this country without appropriate information about their background or their proclivities. Talk us through that, would you, very quickly?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is absolutely, everything you said is absolutely true. We transported a whole bunch of Afghans here about whom we know essentially nothing. So now we will try to figure out who it is we transported into the country. The Department of State has been all along, even when Kabul Airport was still functioning, refusing American blue passport holders transportation out of the country because they didn't appear on some list because they hadn't filed an online form. I mean, this is this kind of surreal world that we're talking about. Keep in mind, again, back to the sort of there is no kinder, gentler Taliban. The Taliban has issued an official order in Afghanistan all unmarried women, females between 15 and 45 must be identified because they will be married, in quotes, to Taliban fighters. So we're talking about seizing a huge number of women and girls and turning them into sex slaves for the Taliban so they can be impregnated to produce a new generation of jihadis. This is the psycho world into which we are abandoning Americans. You know, there was literally an American woman with her children standing on the runway at one point as the last planes were leaving, being told by a State Department consular officer, "You're not on a list. You didn't file your online form. You can't get on a plane." This is the world into which we abandon that woman and her children, one in which go back into Kabul, back into the 6th century, and now become, you know, and now be dragged away literally by the Taliban to service them. This is what we are abandoning our people to.
And to millions of others, as you say, Sam. Just to recap, this is a edict that has been publicly released by the Taliban, or that you've gotten wind of through
that
other channels?
Correct. It has been publicly released in print in Afghanistan, and it is in this. This is what's happening right now for these folks to be dragged away. This is everything that ISIS ever did in its little caliphate in Syria and Iraq. This, you know, times 100. Every bit is evil. Every bit is ugly. Infinitely more powerful. And this administration seriously talking about them as being pragmatic. And we can continue to send aid, partners, absolutely. Next thing you know, they'll want a diplomatic. They will want to diplomatically recognize these guys and release billions of dollars.
I think this is coming, no question about it. Sam Faddis, this is chilling. I think both the psychological warfare element of this to the people of Afghanistan on the one hand, and the inducement, let's be honest, to jihadis to join their ranks and take advantage of this windfall. I mean, even before you get to paradise, perhaps you can get your hands on 70 virgins, thanks to the Taliban. This is very, very, very alarming, needless to say. And we appreciate so much, Sam, the work that you do on End Magazine's pages to acquaint us with all of this. I know you'll stay at it, my friend, and we'll look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Thank you for your time today. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about China and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is a regular here, I'm proud to say. His name is Gordon Chang. He is an author of a number of books, including The Great U.S.-China Tech War and Coming Collapse of China. He is an essayist of prodigious capacity and output, notably at places like Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute these days. He is also a very impressive contributor to the public policy debate through appearances places like this, and of course on his Twitter handle, which is Gordon G. Chang. I encourage you to follow him as I do there. Gordon, as always, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Much to talk about. We'll be visiting with Bill Walton about some of this shortly, but I'd like to get your take on it as well. We've had an unlikely, seemingly quite aligned series of articles from George Soros of late, op-ed pieces mostly, including one in the Wall Street Journal today, Gordon, that sounds an awful lot like, well, Gordon Chang, or Frank Gaffney, Roger Robinson, the Committee on the Present Danger of China, Bill Walton. What do you make of the warnings that he is now producing sort of in a serial fashion about particularly the inadvisability of engaging with China through investments there?
Well, George Soros's warning in the Wall Street Journal op-ed and elsewhere, these really, I think, are a product of reality. He can see what's happening in China. And unlike others, he believes that this is a long-term trend, which I believe it is. Now, we have seen Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, take a number of actions And they're not isolated, Frank. I think they are consistent with his general worldview, and he obviously has the political power to implement them. I believe, actually, there is political turmoil inside Beijing right now, and Xi Jinping's reaction is to double down and to try to press this. But at least for the moment, this certainly looks like a long-term trend and is not just a temporary disruption.
I want to come back to the political turmoil in just a moment, Gordon, because I think that's surpassing importance, obviously. What Soros particularly seems to be concerned about, as he's described it in a couple of places, I think, is that China is now, under Xi's leadership, headed towards a more Maoist kind of governance and sort of economic system, and that is going to be particularly bad for investors. Talk us through the evidence of that and why Mao and his kind of policies, his communist practices, would be absolutely inimical to the kind of capitalist endeavors that we're told, you know, make China such an attractive market and opportunity.
Many foreigners, and indeed, even some Chinese, have ignored what Xi Jinping has been saying from even the time before he became General Secretary of the Communist Party at the end of 2012. He is revered now, and he's made that clear throughout his rule. And that is something that we Americans just generally tend to slough off, saying, oh, no, he can't really mean that. But yes, he can. And his common prosperity plan is a real indication of going back to redistribution of wealth. And also, it's an extortion, because we've seen the largest companies like Alibaba, Tencent, and others fork over billions, tens of billions of dollars to all sorts of causes. Alibaba, I think, $15.5 billion or something. Tencent, almost as much. What Xi Jinping has been talking about really is a number of ways to prevent China from actually liberalizing as we would think it. But his plan is state-owned, state-dominated, very little room for foreigners, even very little room for domestic Chinese private entrepreneurs. And along with this, he's exhibited a tendency to exert totalitarian social control, going down to the smallest behaviors. One thing we've seen is the institution of Xi Jinping thought in the curricula, even down to the early years in primary school, as well as an emphasis on Marxism at all levels of education in China. I don't understand what the Goldman Sachs of the world see when they don't think that this is a permanent shift. I mean, one could argue that Xi Jinping won't get a third term next year as general secretary, and that's entirely possible. But, you know, at this point, that's the only thing that's going to stop China from going back to Maoism.
Well, again, that brings us back to the political piece of this, Gordon Cheng. And you are, of course, on top of this, as few others are. Talk with us about the kinds of enemies that Xi has been creating of late. You've described, sort of in passing at least, this shakedown of corporations. But is it likely that the combined effect of his mistreatment of people like Jack Ma and of Alibaba and, you know, the political enemies that he has spawned with his anti-corruption campaigns and high-handedness more generally, that there really is now the prospect of a challenge to him, if not beforehand, by the time of this next election, as they call it, in the Chinese Communist Party next year?
Well, Xi Jinping has disadvantaged almost everybody in Chinese society, and that makes almost everybody a potential enemy. And this is really I think the hallmark of what's going on in China. Because he's grabbed power from others, he's also made himself fully accountable. I mean, it's very difficult for him to blame others. And at the same time, he's raised the cost of losing political struggles. And that means that the Chinese political system, I think, will become much more unpredictable, And certainly it's going to be much more violent. And this means that China is no longer the stable platform that it once was. One can look at this common prosperity program, mass campaign, really as Xi Jinping's attempt to get common folk in China to side with him. And this is reminiscent, at least in broad outline, of what happened during the Cultural Revolution. Mao Zedong, who had been sidelined at the time, urged the Chinese people to attack the core leadership of the Communist Party. And that decade-long campaign just careened out of control and almost led to the complete collapse of China's government. We're not at the Cultural Revolution yet, but it's clear that from an historical point of view, what we're seeing today is what China saw in the early stages of the Cultural Revolution. We don't know where it will go this time, of course. But we can't exclude a total collapse of Chinese society. That's on the menu right now. And that's certainly going to go back and affect investments in China and long-term commitments that others are making to the Chinese economy and Chinese financial system.
Now, Gordon, especially when you combine, and we'll get into this a bit more with Bill too, but when you combine the lack of transparency with respect to these companies in China, these so-called variable interest entities, and the Chinese Communist Party really, you know, having its finger on what the boards of the companies do with their political commissars and so on, the prospect that you're going to see not only a lack of return on investment reliably, but also that more and more of the value of these companies is going to be, you know, simply absconded with by the government, not just, you know, the fraudsters, but the government itself. It really does reinforce, it seems to me, very powerfully Soros's point that this is not going to end well for American investors if their financial managers like Larry Fink of BlackRock, for example, persist in insisting that more and more and more of their money go down this particular rat hole. So, Gordon, I guess the question that I would put to you very directly is, if you were making book at this point, does this common prosperity scheme stave off the sort of challenge that might otherwise be in the offing for Xi in the next cycle? And if it does, at what cost, again, to, you know, the larger post-Mao economic model that Xi's predecessors had adopted from, I guess, Deng Xiaoping forward?
It's very difficult to make a long-term prediction about who is going to prevail. But the one thing that we can see for sure is that there's going to be a lot of turbulence, and that the markets are going to be trending downward, largely because they've already lost about $3 trillion worth of value. And there's a lot more to go, especially because I believe that the perceptions of the investment community outside China still do not match the reality of what's occurring. There will be more of these mass campaigns. There'll be more of these restrictions on the economy as Xi Jinping heads towards what he sees as a socialist Maoist state. And that means that although Xi Jinping may be chucked out, could be before the 20th National Congress, could be at that event next year or after, nonetheless, people are going to lose money between now and then. Because Xi Jinping has made it very clear that he is serious about implementing his notion of where China should be. And that notion is something that Larry Fink and Ray Dalio and others just don't take seriously.
They're playing with your money, folks, is part of why they evidently don't take it so seriously. But Gordon, let me just come back to one other aspect of this. You've talked about sort of domestic social engineering. What about the possibility of foreign adventurism and aggressiveness as a vehicle for trying to get people to rally around the flag and therefore rally around Xi Jinping and his policies and prospects?
Well, as Xi Jinping it fights with his internal enemies, I think two things are going to happen. One of them is what you point out. China's foreign policy is going to become even more aggressive. You know, we're seeing this not only in India, but also Taiwan. Japan could be a target. So we can't discount the possibility of long-term conflict along China's periphery. And the other thing is that Xi Jinping will close China up. He's already started along that line, and it's going to make it much more difficult to conduct business in China, even if one has favored status like Goldman Sachs. So you put all this stuff together, and the risk is to the downside for all of these reasons, Frank. Upside potential right now is very limited. I mean, we're seeing Wall Street types say, well, it's already declined so much, so it's got to go back up again. Well, yeah, if one looks in the century-long time frame, but for a very long time, and we could be talking decades, China could be at a very low state in terms of markets, and those markets could actually be closed. Very little right now is off the list of possible scenarios.
Analysis, Gordon, and I so appreciate you sharing it with us, especially against the backdrop of your larger point that it is folly for us to be engaging in this country as we have been encouraged to do now for several decades with the Chinese Communist Party. And whether it's on our financial markets or whether it is military to military exchanges, which we have been importuned to basically kickstart under this administration after a period of relative quiescence, I think, on the part of Donald Trump. And then there's John Kerry, and I want to come back to that at the end. But just very quickly, Gordon, you've written about this hotline phone call, the so-called USPRC defense telephone link that took place recently with Michael Chase, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for China, with his Chinese counterpart. What does this tell us about the Biden administration's determination to intensify engagement with China rather than diminish it?
Well, certainly among Biden policymakers, the president himself, and even senior leaders in the Pentagon, there's this belief that we have to maintain constant communication with the Chinese military leadership to avoid conflict. And this is, you know, on its surface, sounds common sense. But the point here, though, is that China doesn't believe in the hotline. It doesn't believe in crisis communications. And as our friend Rick Fisher has pointed out, they believe that they can control the pace of communication to intimidate the United States. We continue chasing after China to talk, and that puts us in a supplicant position. What we should be doing is realizing that the Chinese system doesn't want to talk to us and intimidating them back with our silence. But that has not occurred to people in Washington right now. And I have to say that the senior leadership of the Pentagon, both civilian and military, buys into this false notion of communication. It may have worked with the Soviet Union, but China is not the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's for sure. And Gordon, I guess I'd just add further, as both Rick Fisher and Bill Gertz have pointed out repeatedly, the Chinese have used these military to military exchanges to collect intelligence against us, while not reciprocating with this kind of transparency that the U.S. government has generally provided, particularly the Pentagon. Gordon, lastly, we've got less than a minute, but just very quickly, what is John Kerry up to and what are the risks associated with it?
Well, John Kerry went to Tianjin, where he had a number of Zoom calls and an in-person meeting with China's climate officials and with Wang Yi, the foreign minister, which was a Zoom call. This does not appear to have gone very far for a number of reasons. China is not going to make any climate concessions before the big climate meeting in November, I believe. The one important thing here is that China did not let him go to Beijing. China has been forcing foreign emissaries to go to Tianjin, which is next to Beijing. This goes back to imperial times of making sure that the foreigners understood their secondary role, their supplicant role. So Kerry should not have gone.
And yet he is not only gone, but he is presumably pushing aggressively to try to make further concessions to the Chinese, which he is all about, it seems, as he was with the Iranians before. We'll be following that closely, as I know will you. Gordon Chang, thank you for these visits each week. It is one of the high points of our week, and we look forward to the next one. with great anticipation. God bless you, my friend. Stay well. Keep up the good work and come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton about the capital markets, George Soros, and what the takeaways should be from all of this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Bill Walton. He is the host of a terrific podcast television program called The Bill Walton Show. He is a former Master of the Universe on Wall Street, successful financier turned conservative leader and thought leader at that, and he is a former president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is a great resource for this program. We're always delighted to catch up with him, especially in light of some very, very interesting developments in the capital markets space, especially as they relate to the Chinese Communist Party. Bill Walton, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks, Frank. Much to talk about.
I was really struck by something that has been now tumbling out, it seems, day by day. There's a new broadside, I guess one might call it, by George Soros, a man, to say of the left is an understatement, a man who has been sort of a philanthropic force of nature, advancing, I would say, anti-American agendas of all kinds now for decades with enormous financial investments in various radical groups and causes. And yet, he has now taken to the pages of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and other publications in recent days to denounce Xi Jinping, the dictator of communist China. We were just talking, of course, with Gordon Chang about some of this, but I wanted to get your take on particularly his piece in the Wall Street Journal today, Bill Walton, in which he goes directly at a man who I think is a nemesis for both of us, Larry Fink, who is the CEO of BlackRock and a prime mover behind this idea that Americans should be investing more in communist China, despite what's happening in the markets. George Soros doesn't think so. I don't think you do either. Tell us about what you make of these broadsides from Soros.
Well, in another op-ed where I had to check the byline twice, George Soros take dead aim at Larry Fink at BlackRock. You know, Larry recently told their investors they had to triple their allocation and Chinese assets. And, you know, he goes on to say Chinese markets represent a significant opportunity to help the long-term goals of investors in China. And George Soros just takes dead aim. He says that Larry Fink misunderstands President Xi Jinping's China, and that, you know, he forgets the fact that there's no real private companies in China, Larry Fink does, and that, in fact, you know, Xi regards all Chinese companies as instruments of the one-party state. You know, he also calls out Steve Schwarzman and John Thornton, who had led Blackstone and Goldman Sachs into China. They're still there. We're still seeing all the U.S. companies lobbying to be soft on China so they can get some of that money from China. But he says that, you know, by doing this, they're going to, by putting money into China, BlackRock and all the others are going to directly damage national security interests of the United States. Now, this reads, Frank, like it was written by a Republican senator. I mean, it's really amazing. He concludes by saying that today the U.S. and China are engaged in a life and death conflict, which is true, between two systems of government, repressive and democratic. Now, you and I could probably do a whole show on how repressive the things are that George Soros is attempting to do here in America, like squash free and fair elections. But he, you know, George seems to be all over this. He also points out in a totally unreported story that China is undergoing a lot of internal upheaval. You know, they've still got the demographic bust, which we know. And it's also beginning to see the cracks in the real estate bubble that it's had for years. And its largest real estate developer looks like it's going to go into bankruptcy. And this is a company that had been rated AAA of course, it was rated AAA by the Chinese, and they're pretty soft on their ratings. Looks like it's going to go into the tank in the next few weeks.
Wow, this is huge. This is Evergrande,
this is an interesting development.
You're talking about.
I don't know. We've got a lot to go. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Evergrande you're talking about that is, now having its bonds treated as junk and commanding something like a 13% interest rate. The one thing I would express some misgivings about is your thought that a Republican senator could have written this op-ed piece by George Soros. I'm straining to think of which one it might be. I mean, it sounds like the Committee on the Present Danger China to me, which, of course, you are an important member of, Bill. But anyway, it's being said by somebody who clearly has a lot of stroke on Wall Street. Maybe it's not quite what it used to be because he's now more of a passive investor, I guess, but he's still a big deal, certainly in the world that shapes American policy. And I did want to just highlight something you said, I think, Bill, and that is Politico has been reporting that these other titans of American business on Wall Street and elsewhere, including through their trade associations like the Chamber of Commerce and Business Roundtable and so on, are now aggressively working with others on the radical left in Congress, what they euphemistically call it Politico progressives, but we all know they're, basically Marxists, to try to protect that other Marxist mainstay, namely the Chinese Communist Party, from the kind of legislative initiatives on the capital markets front or others driven by concerns about Chinese human rights abuses and national security threats, to try to stave those off. Talk a little bit about what that portends. I mean, isn't this basically playing for the other team, to put it mildly? It seems to me it's betrayal, basically. And George Soros, I think, is rightly calling people out for it. So where do the progressives come out on all of this, or come off doing
well,
all
I'm
of
not
this,
sure
I should
where
say?
They are. Where they are right now is that the near term, they all see that, forcing corporations to be good governance, environmentalists, engaged in social justice before they pursue any shareholder interest is where the progressive activists have been. And of course, the big companies themselves want to be in business in China. And so they're really urging China, the Biden administration, to ease up on China. Now, okay, that's where we are today, but you got to look where this is going. With George Soros coming out like this, you got to wonder what this is signaling among that progressive world. And as we talked about last week, you've got to wonder whether he's trying to steer this ship away from China and towards other agendas. And we can only speculate that taking dead aim at Larry Fink like this is going to cause some sort of a rupture. Now, but what I believe is, though, that we've seen this debacle in Afghanistan and Biden beating hasty retreat everywhere in the world. I think Biden's next step is to stop being tough on China. And my guess is his next move is going to be to go easy on China. We've got the spectacle of John Kerry going over to China, I guess the second time. It's her third major visit to China in the last 8 months, and basically trying to trade away U.S. security in pursuit of a climate, an ephemeral climate agenda. The foreign policy establishment views climate is the biggest risk they face, along with domestic, white rage terrorism. And China is going to play every card they had. And they handed Kerry a list of things that they'd like to have as a quid pro quo. They said, well, look, you've got to stop investigating our espionage inside the United States and our attempts to steal intellectual property. You got to stop doing that. And also, you've got to stop protecting Taiwan. We joke about connecting dots. This is a very polka-dotted world right now. And George Soros's final recommendation is incredibly powerful. Congress should pass legislation empowering the Securities and Exchange Commission to limit the flow of funds to China.
Wow.
Strong words.
Indeed.
Particularly given the messenger.
And coming from him. Amen.
The other thing we have to follow closely is this, one thing about George is he's a very sophisticated, knowledgeable guy about what's going on in the capital markets and the economy. And he points out the coming real estate bubble collapse potentially in China. This Evergrande, it's a very big deal. I mean, this was the biggest company in China, and they're now inside China. They're calling it the Lehman Brothers of China. Let me come back to this question about
Biden and China, because that's a really important point, and I want to drill down on it with you. But very quickly, on one of the other things that Soros threw down, specifically with respect to Larry Fink, is the hypocrisy, basically, of his whole ESG agenda when it comes to China, which is something you and I have been talking about now for months. It's very heartening to us, I think, and it has to be very distressing to those progressive leftists that they're being called out on it. And I hope that it will cause some, rethinking at a minimum, and better yet, some course corrections on the part of Fink and company in what they're trying to do to bend all American corporations to their will in terms of ESG, and all American investors to their will in terms of investing in a country that doesn't give a fig about environment, social justice, or governance, namely China.
Well, I hope this brings a smile to you, because this is just staggering. George Soros is now saying that Xi, in launching his Common Prosperity Program, which is, of course, is a nod to the progressives in the United States who want to make China, Xi wants to make China investable for BlackRock. And by ESG, which is sort of a code word Common Prosperity, which is maybe their code word for ESG, George Soros says that by pursuing this does not augur well for foreign investors. In other words, Chinese companies proclaiming not to pursue economic objectives is bad for investors. So George Soros is basically saying this ESG thing is not great if you're looking for good returns to shareholders.
Even if you're not driven by these moral platitudes and virtue signaling, it's going to be bad for you in terms of the value of your investments. All of which is to simply say we shouldn't be investing in communist China, period. And George Soros as an ally is somewhat unsavory as well as unlikely bedfellow, but there it is. Let me just come back to the Biden bit. We've got a couple of minutes, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about this, Bill. We've been documenting, notably at accountabilityinitiative.org, the deep compromises that the Chinese Communist Party has achieved vis-a-vis virtually all of the senior folks in the Biden-Harris administration, whether it's their outright gifts, or they're having done business together in various influence operations or other ties, an alignment at a minimum. And when you talk about, Bill, the prospect that Biden is going to go soft on China, I think it's a question of whether he's going to go softer on China. There have been some things that have been a little bit robust, keeping some of the Trump capital market sanctions in place, for example. But by and large, I think, especially as you say, you look at what's gone down with Afghanistan and what seems now in prospect in the South China Sea and elsewhere, especially if John Kerry has his way, is likely to be very much consistent with this problem that the president and his advisors are basically, deeply compromised, is to put it mildly. When you look at that, Bill, knowing what you do about China, knowing what you do particularly about it's unrestricted warfare against this country. It's people's war against us. What does that suggest in terms of whether we're looking at really the betrayal of vital U.S. interests by our own government vis-a-vis China?
Well, it doesn't betray. Well, words fail, Frank. I mean, we're getting all sorts of signals from our military that we're not prepared to engage in actual warfare. There was a recent report about the surface fleet of the United States and that the morale is horrible. We're not prepared to do any kinetic action, and that everybody's engaged in diversity training. And, you know, we're all for diversity, but you ought to be teaching people how to fight with their ships. They're not doing that. We're pulling down our ICBM. We're neglecting ICBM. We're neglecting submarines. We're neglecting all of these ways to defend the country. And we've got our foreign policy establishment really not aiming to do anything. So we, even if we did want to show muscle against China and the kinetic front, we're incapable of doing that right now. I mean, we're living on borrowed time there. It gets back to the culture of the progressives. I mean, people have been making common cause with, we invited the Chinese into our world trade system thinking they'd become more like us, and that didn't happen. And very few people have, in the John Kerry world have awakened to the fact that their interests are much, much different than and in opposition to ours.
Yeah. Well, and we see, I think, at their hands, the progressives, the Kerrys and others, Biden, more of a migration of this country in the direction of China rather than the other way around. Bill, we have to leave it at this for today. Thank you for your time, as always, your expertise, and particularly your insights on what's going on in the capital markets in China. We really appreciate them, and we look forward to visiting with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Keep up the good work at The Bill Walton Show. Check it out, folks. It is required viewing. I hope you will also come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The betrayal of our country involved in Joe Biden's humiliating strategic defeat in Afghanistan has prompted calls for his resignation, impeachment, and even his court-martialing. As awareness grows that a prime beneficiary of this debacle is the Chinese Communist Party, the fact that it has deeply compromised the president and his team can only reinforce demands for accountability. Unfortunately, other betrayals are also aiding communist China. Even uber-leftist George Soros recognizes that, quote, the U.S. and China are engaged in a life-and-death conflict, unquote, and warns Americans should not invest in such an enemy. Yet, Politico reports that Wall Street and other business groups are working with so-called progressives on Capitol Hill to block legislative initiatives aimed at punishing the CCP for its human rights abuses and national security threats. Such betrayals must be terminated forthwith, and costs accrue to their perpetrators. This is